Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I have to, of course, start by saying happy 200th birthday to Charles Darwin. And, of course, approximately 150 years since the publication of The Origin of Species. And I will tell you more about that. We'll have actually a quote from that further on in the talk. So the focus of the research in my lab is to try to identify, for example, genetic variants that result in differentiation of humans from our closest genetic relatives, the chimpanzees, and also from each other. So I'm interested in identifying what are the genetic variants associated with normal variable traits, things like height, for example, or lactose tolerance that I'll tell you about, and those that might be associated with risk for disease. So I want to start by giving you a little bit of background information about how much genetic diversity exists within and among modern humans. So with the sequencing of the human genome, we now know, and we've also actually sequenced the genomes of a number of other primates, including chimpanzees, and we've shown that we're about 98.8% similar to chimps at the nucleotide level. So that's a remarkable amount of similarity, and we're interested in knowing what are the actual variants that might result in the, of course, obvious differences between humans and chimps. What about amongst humans? We're about 99.9% more, actually, similar to each other if we look across the entire genome. We know that, in fact, if we were to take a chromosome and sequence that chromosome, we would differ at about one out of every 500 to 1,000 positions. So that corresponds to about 10 million variants, and they can occur in many different combinations because of recombination shuffling that occurs every generation. And that's more than enough variation to ensure individual uniqueness. But if we look amongst populations, we find that about 85% of the genetic diversity is within populations, and only about 15% among populations. So we're pretty closely related overall as a species. So this is actually showing levels of genetic diversity in different human populations. And the height of the bar indicates the level of diversity. So higher the bar, higher the level of diversity. And here are the African populations. We can see that they're most diverse, and then we see decreasing diversity as we move into the Middle East and Europe, and then into East Asia, Oceania, and the Americas. And here, this maroon bar is indicating the number of unique genetic variants in a particular region. So this is showing that there are more variants that are unique to Africa than any other region of the world. And that's simply reflecting our evolutionary history. So it's thought, based on the fossil record, that modern humans originated in Africa roughly about 200,000 years ago. So some of the earliest fossil data of anatomically modern humans is from Ethiopia, roughly, again, about 195,000 years ago. It's thought that a small group migrated out of Africa somewhere around 50,000 to 100,000 years ago and dispersed across the rest of the globe. And so that's indicated here by the arrows. One of the earliest migration events was into Australia. We have archaeological data that suggests that modern humans were in that region by as early as 50,000 years ago. And in fact, it was proposed that there may have been a distinct early migration event out of Africa, across southern Asia, and into Oceania, into Papua New Guinea and other regions, Australia and Papua New Guinea. And then there were other distinct and more recent migrations, for example, into Europe, into East Asia. And we think about somewhere between 15,000 to 35,000 years ago into the Americas via the Bering Straits. So there is actually a connection here within that time period. Now, within Africa, modern humans, given that our species arose in that region, we've had a lot of time to accumulate genetic diversity. And we were also interested in knowing how diverse are African populations from each other. So now I have to give you a little bit of background about some African languages. And of course, I'm not the expert here. Chris Arrett really is. But I'll give you some general background. So Africa is an incredibly diverse region. It's diverse in terms of cultural diversity, linguistic diversity, environmental diversity, and as I'll show you, in terms of genetic diversity as well. So there are roughly 2,000 distinct ethno-linguistic groups in Africa, and they speak languages that can be classified into four major language families. And these include, in blue, are populations that speak an Afro-Asiatic language. So those would include mainly people from Northern Africa and Eastern Africa. So we have Cushitic speakers, who are very common in Kenya and Tanzania, Ethiopia. We have Semitic speakers, that is a language that's also shared with the Middle East. And then, again, more Semitic languages in the northern part. In red, we have populations that speak a Nilo-Saharan language. So these, you would often associate them with as being people who have cattle, pastoralists. So, for example, the Maasai, you may have heard of. And they tend to be in Eastern Africa and sort of Central Africa. And then in yellow, we have populations that speak what's called a Niger-Kordofanian language. And the most common language in that group are the Bantu languages. And it's thought that the Bantu languages arose in Nigeria or Cameroon, and then there was a expansion or migration of people across Africa within the past 5,000 years. And they brought with them the practice of slash-and-burn agriculture. And then the last language family has been classified as Khoisan, and these are click-speaking populations. So if you've seen The Gods Must Be Crazy, this was the hunter-gatherer group that was featured in that movie, and I cannot pronounce the click. Probably Chris could do it, but I can't. So can you do it?
Well, there's an antelope that you might see in the zoo, the kudu.
Okay, one of these days I'm going to learn how to do that. So the Khoisan would be an example of a population, one of these hunter-gatherer groups in southern Africa. But interestingly, there are two other groups who live in Tanzania who also speak with a click, and they're called the Hadza and the Sandawe. But it's interesting because linguistically, they're very divergent from each other. So although they have clicks, they're still quite divergent. And it's been a real mystery. How are they related to each other, and how are they related to the Southern African click speakers? So I've had a longstanding interest in studying African genetic diversity. I think it's really important for a number of reasons. One is that if we want to learn more about human origins and the fact that our species arose in Africa, we need to be looking in that region. There's also a lot of interest in the African-American community to learn more about their ancestry. And so we'll talk about today what are the possibilities about tracing ancestry back to particular regions in Africa. We also know Africa's a region, unfortunately, with a lot of infectious disease. And the three biggest killers are malaria, TB, and HIV. So one of the things we're interested in doing is finding genetic variants that might play a role in providing resistance to infectious disease and maybe help us to develop better treatments. And it may also be important for finding the genetic basis of susceptibility or risk for certain diseases common in people of recent African descent, like prostate cancer, hypertension, and diabetes. And then lastly, we know that people respond differently to drugs based on genetic variation. So we hope to look across many African populations. Now, although it's such an important region, there was very little known about genetic variation in Africa. And part of the reason for that is that it's very challenging to obtain DNA samples from that region. Many of the groups that we've studied are from fairly remote regions, and we have to take a four-wheel drive vehicle, a Land Rover in this case, to get to these populations, often on unpaved roads. And we have to bring all of our equipment with us. We're basically taking a portable lab with us. This is a group of the Click speakers named the Hadza that I was telling you about who live in Tanzania. And although I speak a little bit of Kiswahili, I do not speak the indigenous Click language, so we have translators. But one of the things that we're particularly careful about is making sure that we do this research in an ethical manner. So that means that we go through multiple levels of review and have to explain the project to the local people. We also obtain information about ethnicity and language spoken and so on. The other thing we were interested in doing, we also wanted to characterize just normal variable traits like height and weight, for example, and see if eventually we might be able to identify genetic variants that are associated with those traits. So in the second half of my talk, I'll tell you about how we looked at the ability to digest milk amongst East African people who have cattle. This was actually a challenging test where we were looking at taste perception, how people taste actually bitter substances. And it's thought that that may have evolved as an ability to detect poisons, for example, in plants. And so this is a group called the El Molo. They live on the edge of Lake Turkana in Kenya, and they were very kind, and they let us use their boat because just finding a space to do this research could be challenging. But from each of these populations, we obtained blood. And then we had to figure out how do we process this blood in a region with no electricity in most places. So we had to use some creative methods like hooking up a centrifuge to the car battery. But in most places, you could usually find, there's usually a mission hospital or a clinic, a place where they may have a generator and we can set up our lab. And what we do is after we obtain blood, you actually break up the red cells in the blood and you spin down the white cells in the blood, this little pellet here, and that's what actually has your DNA. Now, the next challenge, you have no electricity. How are we going to process this in these remote regions? And so what we do is we actually can add a solution that stabilizes the DNA and you can just carry it, basically carry it with us. We put it in these small boxes and are able to transport it back to the U.S., and then we can finish working in the lab in the U.S. to get the DNA. But you can kind of get a sense of what the conditions are in the places where we work. So in the first part of my talk, I want to tell you about the results of the paper that was mentioned earlier that we just recently published in Science Express. And this was very much a collaborative effort involving a very large team of international collaborators, including many African researchers. And particularly want to, of course, acknowledge Chris Arrett, who provided the linguistic data that I'll be talking about. So what we did, I realize that many of you don't have detailed scientific background, so I'll just generalize that we looked at 1,300 sites in the genome that are variable. So people can have different variants at these sites. And we measured these variants in over 3,000 Africans from 121 distinct populations across Africa. Also in a comparative set of African Americans and in a set of 1,000 globally diverse populations. So again, I know a bit of detail. We'll give a little bit of an intro genetics talk for some of you. So what we're looking at are variants that involve a short insertion or deletion of a small segment of DNA, or in some cases, short repetitive segments, and people can vary in terms of the number of repeats. So you've probably heard about the infamous, of course you all know, the OJ trial. And of course, the markers that they use, that they talked about in that trial, this is actually a type of marker that they use. And it's used a lot in forensics because it's so variable. And it's actually very useful for tracing human migration and looking at how people are related to each other. So if we look at the populations included in this study, you can see that includes a broad region in Africa, although tends to be a bit more concentrated in the places where we did our field work, and includes populations that speak all of these languages belonging to all of these four major language families. Now, I should point out that in advance that even though this was the largest study that's been done to date of variation in the genome in Africans, there's a lot of regions that have not been well studied, and we absolutely need to do more, particularly in North Africa and in Central Africa. So again, I want to start by showing you overall levels of genetic diversity. And this is similar to what I showed you before, that the higher the bar, the more diversity there is. And if we look in Africa, we can see that Africans who are color-coded in orange have the most genetic diversity on a worldwide level. And the genetic diversity tends to decrease as you move across Europe, Middle East, Europe, into India, East Asia, Oceania, so Papua New Guinea, and then into Americas. And that's consistent with this historic migration, modern humans out of Africa, across Eurasia, and then more recently into these other regions. So one thing that we can do, I know you can't read this in detail, you're not expected to, I'm just going to point out some of the overall patterns here. This is representing all the populations that we included in our study. And what we can do is look at how similar populations are based on their genetics. And we can construct a tree from that. And so in this tree, populations that are very similar to each other will be located very close to each other in the tree. And the further apart populations are, the more genetically divergent they are. So one thing that we notice is that populations tend to cluster by major geographic regions. So here we have populations from the Americas, from East Asia, Europe, Central Asia, and India. Here's Papua New Guinea and Melanesia, the Middle East, and then here are all the African populations. Now, even within Africa, populations tend to cluster by geographic regions. So here are the North Africans, East Africans, Central Africans, and then we have the San. And a number of studies have shown that the San have some of the most ancestral or ancient lineages present in humans. So it's thought that they may descend from a population that was one of the oldest populations, descendants of one of the oldest populations. So this cloud here of dots, what I'm going to show you now is before I was showing you how populations are related to each other. Now we're going to look at individuals. So each one of these dots represents a person. And after looking at all this genetic variation, we try to figure out how are they related to each other. So again, if the dot clusters very closely, then these people are genetically similar. And we've color-coded it by the geographic origin where these people originated from. And the first thing we notice is that, again, we can distinguish, for example, American Indians from people with East Asian ancestry, Oceanic ancestry. Here are Indian people of Indian ancestry, European and Middle Eastern ancestry, and here are the African populations. And the one that stands out here, these individuals, that's that Hadza population, the hunter-gatherers that I had showed you. If we look just within Africa, we can get a little bit more fine scale of a picture. And again, all of the hunter-gatherer groups stand out here. So here are the Hadza, here are the Kunxan, click speakers from South Africa, and these are Pygmies from Central Africa. And again, we can see that within Africa, we see that genetic diversity is correlated with geography. So people from East Africa are more similar than those from, or more different, I should say, from South Africans, for example. All right. So now this pretty colored picture is actually the crux of this study that we recently published. And the general picture that I want you to get, and in fact, I actually think that I'm going to just go ahead and go to this one because I think it's easier to see. It's hard to tell, but each of these is made up of a number of lines. And each line represents a person. And what we do is we look at all these different genetic variants, and we try to infer ancestry. And each color represents an inferred ancestral population. So, for example, these are Europeans and people from the Middle East, and they generally show this blue ancestry, and people from Asia generally show what we're showing here. It's pink, and then we can distinguish people from Oceania, the Americas, and here are people from India. Now, when you see people who have mixed colors, it means they have mixed ancestry from different regions. So these are actually people from Central Asia, for example. And we can see that they have some ancestry probably from Europe or the Middle East and also from East Asia. So the point I want to make here is if you look at all these different colors, this is Africa here, and all the colors represent all the diversity that we're seeing in that region. So it's just an amazingly genetically diverse region of the world. And some of the populations that stand out, for example, in yellow are those Hadza hunter-gatherers, and in purple are East African populations, in orange are West African people, many of whom speak a Bantu language, in green are pygmy hunter-gatherers from Central Africa, in bright green are the Kungsan, and very interestingly, they seem to show some connections to the pygmies. In red are Nilo-Saharan-speaking people. But again, the main point is to... Oh, and here are the Sandawe click speakers shown in brown there. So as we can see, Africa, not only is it very genetically diverse, but we can see that there's also a lot of mixed ancestry, likely representing migration events in the region. I'm actually going to skip that. So if we look just in Africa, and we can summarize the genetic variation we're seeing by these pie charts, and again, you can actually reconstruct historic migration events. So for example, these orange populations represent the Bantu expansion that came out of Nigeria or Cameroon, spread across Africa. And then when people migrated, they intermarried or mixed with some of the local people. So we see quite a bit of diversity today. And what's really amazing, for example, if you look, this is northern Tanzania in the area near Arusha. So if anybody's been to the Serengeti, it's like very close to that, and Ngorongoro. In that small geographic region, there's just an amazing amount of genetic diversity. And again, representing historic migrations into the region. And it's really interesting that we can try to trace those migrations using genetics. In fact, very interestingly, here are those San populations showing common ancestry with pygmies in Central Africa. So, in fact, one of the conclusions from the study is that here are four very distinct hunter-gatherer populations in Africa. The Hadza, I told you, are from Tanzania. The Sandawe live nearby, but they speak a very divergent language that has clicks. This is a member of the Kungsan from southern Africa, also speak with a click. And here are pygmies from Central Africa. Now, these people are culturally fairly divergent. There are a number of differences. They live in very different environments. Three of them speak with a click. They have languages that contain clicks. And we're finding now evidence for very ancient connections amongst all of these populations. So one thing that it raises is the possibility that the pygmies who lost their indigenous language may have at some point have spoken, their indigenous language may have contained clicks. It also suggests that perhaps these now geographically diverse hunter-gatherers may have, it's hypothesized that they may have originated in East Africa and then become separated, possibly as much as 50,000 years ago. So the other thing that we're able to look at is the origin of African-American populations. We're also, one of the other groups that we looked at is the self-identified, they're called the Cape Colored population in South Africa. And they're very interesting, actually, because they historically, we know that they result from admixture or intermarriage between Afrikaners, who of course are of European origin. We can also see ancestry from Bantu speakers and from the indigenous Klik speakers, and actually a very large Indian component as well. And it matches very much with what we know about the history of those populations. And in fact, that population shows the most distinct ancestry from globally diverse populations that we've seen anywhere in the world. And again, it's reflecting what we know about the history of this group. If we look at African Americans, and here we're showing individuals, each of these actually represents a line, and we can see by the amount of orange ancestry that, as we expected, most ancestry is from Western Africa. This is not a surprise based on what we know about history of the slave trade. We also see considerable European ancestry, but it can vary quite a bit on an individual level. So it could be in the individuals we studied, 0 to greater than 50%. But what was also interesting is that we saw very low levels of ancestry from other regions. And so we actually saw low levels of ancestry from East Africa, and that may reflect historic slave trade from east along the southeastern coast of Africa, around southern Africa, and then to the west coast of Africa, and to the Caribbean and to the Americas. We also see a little bit, it's hard to tell here, but the Fulani is a group or a set of populations that exist across a wide range of West Africa. And they're actually a nomadic group that has cattle, and we can see clear evidence of ancestry, Fulani ancestry, in a number of African-American individuals. But again, predominantly, we're seeing West African ancestry. Now, one of the questions that people very often ask is, can we trace ancestry to a particular region or a particular ethnic group in Africa? And this study actually suggests that it's going to be very difficult to do that, because we're not able, you can just see that we can trace them back to a region, West Africa, but we can't distinguish particular populations within that region. So I think it's going to show that it may be challenging to trace back ancestry from the genome to particular regions in Africa. So I now want to bring us back to Darwin for a moment. And don't worry, I'm not going to read this entire thing. I'm just going to focus actually on the part that I highlighted in yellow. And this is from the book on the origin of species that Darwin published in 1859, his seminal book. And I actually will just read the very beginning. He says, "Can it then be thought improbable, seeing that variations useful to man have undoubtedly occurred, that other variations useful in some way to each being in the great and complex battle of life should sometimes occur in the course of thousands of generations?" And he says further, "This preservation of favorable variations and the rejection of injurious variations I call natural selection." So variations neither useful nor injurious would not be affected by natural selection and would just be fluctuating elements. And in fact, it's amazing how well this holds up today. So in the last part of my talk, what I want to tell you about is our studies of how modern human populations have adapted to diverse environments. And here I'm showing four of the populations that we've studied: pygmy individual from Central Africa, a Bantu-speaking individual who actually lives in the village nearby this pygmy individual. This is an East African pastoralist who from the Samburu tribe, and here are the Hadza hunter-gatherers. Now, not only are these groups very culturally divergent, they're very linguistically divergent, they live in very different environments. So the pygmies live in tropical rainforests, and as do the neighboring Bantu. These other groups live in more sort of dry grassland and sometimes in deserts. And so the idea is that, and they have very different diets as well. So pygmies and Hadza are traditional hunters and gatherers. And the Samburu have cattle, so they rely very much on cattle and milk consumption. And the Bantu speakers practice agriculture predominantly, but of course, they also sometimes would have cattle as well. But we're interested in how, when people adopted these different diets, because until 10,000 years ago, we were all hunter-gatherers. So everyone practiced a hunting and gathering lifestyle till about 10,000 years ago. And now we're interested in when people changed their diets, did the genes, can we see changes in the genes as well? How did people adapt to these different environments and different diets? And so the study I'm going to tell you about is our study of the ability to drink milk in East African pastoralists. And that was actually published in Nature Genetics a couple of years ago. So our ability to digest milk as adults, in fact, I should point out that many people don't realize that most mammals, and in fact, most humans, can't digest milk as adults. So that's actually a very recently derived trait, a very recently derived ability. And so typically, after weaning at about age 4 to 6, we lose the ability to drink milk. But in some of us, that ability is maintained as adults. And the reason why is because we have an enzyme that allows us to metabolize the sugar present in milk. And that sugar is called lactose. So this enzyme, call it lactase, is expressed in the small intestine, and it's very specific to that region. And in people who have that enzyme expressed as adults, it breaks up that sugar, lactose, into two other types of sugar called glucose and galactose, and they're able to go into the bloodstream. In those of us who are not able, they don't have active forms of that enzyme, they're not able to break down that sugar. It goes down into the lower gut and causes severe intestinal distress. And of course, that could be very maladaptive, particularly in an African environment, you could imagine. So it's long been known, it's been proposed that this is a classic example of an adaptive trait. The ability to drink milk, and I'm going to refer to that as lactase persistence. So this would be people who are lactose tolerant. They're able to drink milk. And that's because they have the enzyme is persistent. So we call it lactase persistent. And we know that that is very common in people from Northern Europe. So Finns, for example, I think it's something like 99% of the people can drink milk in Finland. And in fact, if you can't drink milk, they consider that to be really just a terrible disorder. And it decreases in frequency as you go into Southern Europe. And then going into the Middle East, moderate frequency, about 50% or so can digest milk. It's actually very low prevalence in Asia and in West Africa. And however, people in East Africa who have cattle have adapted the ability to drink milk as adults. And we wanted to learn something about what is the genetic basis of that adaptation. Okay, don't get scared by this figure. So remember, I told you that in Finland, if you can't drink milk, this is really considered terrible. So there was a Finnish group that looked at families where they couldn't digest milk as adults. And they used some genetic methods to try to identify what are the genetic variants that result in lactose intolerance in those people. And they were able to map, to identify particular regions in the genome that allowed them to digest milk. So this is showing you, we're sort of zooming in. This is one of the chromosomes in the genome, chromosome 2, and we're zooming in now to this region along the chromosome. And there's a gene here for the enzyme lactase. Nearby, they found a genetic variant, and this is really turns out to be the important one. It was located about 14,000 these are called nucleotides, so our DNA is composed of either A, T, G, or Cs. And if you go out 14,000 of these, you find this variant. So those of us in this room who can drink milk, if we're of European descent, we likely have this T at that position. People who can't drink milk would have a C at that position. And in fact, now this is being offered as a genetic test. Oh, and let me just go back and point out that when we sequenced that region, we looked at that region in Africans, they didn't have that variant. So we knew there had to be something else that enabled East Africans to drink milk. So what we did is we actually gave a test. It's called a lactose tolerance test. And this is a former graduate student named Quayle. And what we have to do is we give them the sugar lactose that's present in milk, mix it up with water. And this is a group of Maasai women. We have everybody line up and drink this at one time. Okay. Now, one of the challenges is just getting people to participate for about an hour is how long it takes to do this test. So what we do is at the time that they drink the sugar, we take a measurement to determine the level of glucose in their blood. And every 20 minutes, we measure the level of glucose. And you can just do this with a diabetes monitor type of kit to measure blood sugar. And the way that we diagnose lactose tolerance is if you have a very rapid rise in your blood sugar, then you're considered to be lactose tolerant. And if you don't have a rapid rise, then you're lactose intolerant. So we were able to classify these people in East Africa, and we looked at about 500 people from Tanzania, Kenya, and the Sudan. And this shows you the prevalence of lactose tolerance. So in light blue shows the frequency of people who can drink milk. And in dark blue are people who can't drink milk. And in this medium-colored blue are people who are sort of intermediate. We can't really classify them. But the group that has the highest prevalence of lactose tolerance are the Beja group from northern Sudan. They are very traditional pastoralists. And so, for example, I've been told they drink something like liters of milk every day. They're nomadic. They have both cattle, but they also have camels. And so, not surprisingly, they have a very high prevalence of lactose tolerance. But we can see that it's pretty common in many different groups in East Africa. The lowest prevalence is in a group of hunter-gatherers called the Sundawe. And again, perhaps it's not too big a surprise. So we actually were able to identify a number of novel genetic variants that allowed Africans in that region to drink milk. And so they're shown here. Here's the European one. And here are the three mutations that we found in green and purple and red. What was kind of interesting is that two of these were mainly found in people from northern Kenya and the Sudan, so sort of more in northeastern region. And this one shown in red was very common in Tanzania and Kenya. So the Maasai, for example, had this variant right here. So in this case, people who had a C could digest milk, and people who had a G could not. This is just showing a very strong association. So we actually tested the ability to digest milk and look, does it associate with that variant? And in fact, it does. It's a very, very strong association. So here I've shown you the prevalence of lactose tolerance. And here we've measured the frequency of the variants that we found. And the main point here is that we can see generally a pretty good correlation between the genetic frequency of this variant and the ability to digest milk. However, it's clear that we haven't found all the variations. So if you look here, for example, in southern Sudan, there's a fairly high prevalence of lactose tolerance, about 50% of the population. We didn't find any of these variants. So there's more out there that we haven't even found yet. Now, one of the groups that was kind of surprising was the Hadza. So according to this test, about 50% of them could drink milk. Now, why would a group of hunter-gatherers be able to drink milk? That's something I still haven't figured out, and we plan to go back there and to do some more testing. There's a couple of possibilities. So one possibility is maybe they had cattle in the past, and they no longer do today. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that the enzyme that lets people drink milk, the full name is lactase fluorazine hydrolase, Fluorazine actually plays a role in digesting certain sugars found in barks of certain plants from the rosacea family. So that would actually include pears, for example, pears and apple trees. It is possible that there's other aspects of their diet that that enzyme plays an important role in. And that's something that we're going to look at in the future. So one of the things we were interested in detecting is, could we find a genetic footprint of natural selection? So we sort of want to, you know, of course, at the time that Darwin came up with his theory of natural selection, he knew nothing about it. At the time, Mendel actually simultaneously was working in a different region, but Darwin didn't know about that. And now we actually understand the molecular basis of variation and adaptation. And what we were interested in doing was seeing, was there a genetic footprint left behind? And so imagine here, I've just shown you, imagine that this red dot is the genetic variant that enables people who have it to drink milk. And nearby are some other genetic variants. They're shown in different dots here. If people who have that genetic variant are able to survive to an older age, maybe they're able to have more children, that variant's going to rise in frequency in the population. And with enough time, everybody in the population will have the variant. And when that happens, it brings with it nearby variation. With enough time, because of the shuffling that occurs every generation and new mutation, that's going to break up. But what we saw, in fact, was a remarkable genetic footprint of natural selection. So in red, these are people who have two copies of the mutation C that lets them drink milk. And in blue are people who have two copies of the G variant and they can't drink milk. And if we just look at the region of the genome going over 3 million nucleotides, so looking at a big region of the chromosome nearby, people who have that mutation that lets them drink milk, they're pretty much identical going out 3 million base pairs. That's indicated by the length of the line. People who don't have the mutation, they don't show that at all. And it's a classic example of what we expect if there's positive selection of this mutation. And if we look at Europeans, they have a different variant, but a similar pattern. They've also, we can see that genetic footprint. This is a way of looking at how these chromosomes are related to each other. So this is a chromosome that has the European mutation, and this is a chromosome with the most common African mutation. And these lines indicate mutation events that connect them. And the point is to see that they arose independently. So clearly the one in Africa is completely independent from the mutation that was in Europe. And by using computer simulation, we can actually estimate the age of the mutation, both in Europe and also in Africa. So the European mutation, we estimate, you can see the dates here, to be roughly about 8,000 to 9,000 years of age. And the East African mutation, we're estimating to be about 3,000 to roughly 7,000 years old. And what's interesting is that it actually corresponds very well with what we know from the archaeological data about the origins of cattle domestication and pastoralism. So it's thought that some of the earliest evidence for domestication of cattle comes from data from the Middle East and from northern Africa, dated to somewhere between, say, 7,000 to 9,000 years ago. And so that's very consistent with the estimate for the age of the mutation that's present, very common in Europe, and probably originated in this area. By contrast, the mutation that's very common in this region of Africa dates, again, to about 3,000 to 7,000 years. And we know that cattle weren't introduced south of the Sahara to roughly 5,000 years ago. So that was really an amazing correlation between the genetics and the archaeology. And we know that there have been more recent migrations, for example, into southern Africa. So if we look at the two populations that had the oldest age estimate for that mutation, this is just two individuals from one of the groups from each. So these are, for example, Maasai and Samburu Nilotic speakers, and they're thought to have originated from southern Sudan roughly about 3,000 or so years ago. And this individual speaks a Cushitic language, and the people in this population are thought to have migrated from Ethiopia, probably about within the past 5,000 or so years, into Kenya and into Tanzania. And both of these age estimates are pretty old. We can't say for sure which group it arose in, although I would actually guess probably in the group that came from Ethiopia. And the reason I say that is we don't find the mutation in southern Sudan. So that makes me think that more likely it arose in this group. But either way, there was clearly quite a bit of genetic exchange between the two. And so you have the co-evolution of a new type of technology, which is cattle domestication, together with a genetic adaptation that rapidly spread across the region and enabled people to, if it wasn't for that technological innovation, we probably wouldn't see that mutation. It wouldn't be so common. It clearly gave people who had it an advantage. And the last thing that I'll mention is that the reason that I think this particular example is important is because one of the interesting things is that the variant we found was very geographically restricted. It was only found in Kenya and Tanzania, pretty much. We've actually done some further work, and we do find it in other places where there's been migration from that region. But it means that there may be other genetic variants out there that play a very important role in adaptation, and some of them might play a role in disease. And they may be different in populations from different regions of Africa. So I think the study also shows that we need to look at genetic variation across diverse ethnic groups in Africa. And a question that I frequently get is, are humans still evolving? And I think this is an example that, yes, we are. Here is a mutation that arose just in the past few thousand years and rapidly swept through East Africa because it had such a major advantage for people who had this variant. And I will just end by thanking the many, many people who contributed to the study, many people in my lab, and of course, many African collaborators, Chris Arrett. And just say thank you again for having me here. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Would you comment on the prevalence of malaria susceptibility and immunity?
Sure. So that's actually something that we have studied in the past. So malaria, it's very prevalent, particularly in areas that have rainforests and a tropical environment. So if we had a map, you'd see it pretty much very prevalent across sort of the central belt of Africa, but it does extend to many different regions. And we've actually identified there have been a number of genetic variants found that provide resistance. So one of the best known is the variant that also causes sickle cell anemia. And that's quite common, particularly in West Africa. And the reason why it's so common, even though people who have two copies of that variant are extremely ill, they're going to die. If you're living in Africa and you have the sickle cell disease, you're not going to be able to survive. But what's interesting is that people who have one copy with that mutation and one normal copy they're more resistant to malaria. And so it's such a strong selective advantage that this mutation rose to high frequency, even though it can cause such devastating disease. And we found other examples that a gene called G6PD, mutations in that gene can cause very severe anemia. And yet we see it being quite prevalent in different parts of Africa. And we actually dated that to about 6,000 years of age. And that was interesting because it's been thought that malaria may have become more prevalent after the introduction of agriculture, that people were cutting down the forest and there were open pools of water, more mosquitoes, and then more malaria. And in fact, again, the ages correlated fairly well.
I thought it was really interesting that you found so many genetic variants that caused the production of lactase. And Did you check to see if the lactase that was produced by those different variants was the exact same enzyme? And could the differences cause, you suggested that possibly they can, that the lactase helps them to digest plant matter and go on.
So, yeah, actually, we did not sequence. You'd have to then sequence the lactase gene itself. We haven't done that, but other people have. And they were not able to find any particular genetic variants in the gene for lactase itself. So it appears that what is important, and thank you for actually pointing this out, because that's something I should have emphasized, that this mutation regulates the level of the lactase gene. So people who have the African variant that I was talking about, they maintain higher levels of the gene as adults. So it's important in regulation of gene expression. Thank you for pointing that out.
Is there lactose tolerance among Asians who have cattle versus Asians who do not have cattle?
So being a non-expert in Asia, I'm actually, there's probably someone here who might be able to answer that. Does anybody know? Because I actually don't know about Asia. I know that it's not very common in most Asian populations, but I'm not sure about populations that have cattle.
You showed 1% among the Chinese.
Yeah, so, but I don't, I mean, are there particular Asian groups that have pastoralism? I'm not. Oh, in India, yes, yes. I was thinking East Asia, so you're absolutely right. So India, it's a moderate level, but it's a different variant. So people have looked, and there's a very low prevalence of the European variant. In fact, it's very low in Middle East as well. One of the variants that we found in East Africa is more common in the Middle East. So again, they probably have different variants. There's more to be discovered. I know people are looking in India to try to find other variants.
Sarah, I had a question about reconstructing the, you mentioned that a relatively small band of humans moved through Asia to the Americas. And I was wondering, within Africa, as more genetic information accumulates, mm-hmm. will it be possible to reconstruct the population sizes of the migrant groups that move? Because one of the questions is, this impacts the question of the evolution of language, too. How many speakers were there of these languages? Mm-hmm. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on the potential to reconstruct population abundance history and migration.
So we can, and there have been a lot of studies that have already attempted to do that. I mean, what we know generally is that the long-term, what we call effective population size, which is number of breeding individuals, is about 10,000 for humans. And people are very surprised when they hear that number. My students say, "What? I don't understand how there's, you know, look at how many modern humans there are. How can it be 10,000? It's because it's more strongly influenced by the size of the population when it was at its smallest. So if we look outside of Africa, the estimates are roughly 10,000, sometimes a bit less, sometimes 8,000 or so. And if we look in Africa, it's roughly 15,000. So we know that Africans certainly have maintained a larger population size over the long term. A number of studies of some of these hunter-gatherer groups, for example, have shown that they seem to maintain a fairly small, stable population size, whereas some of the groups that practice agriculture or pastoralism have experienced rapid population expansions and growth. And again, probably consistent again with this more stable food source that enables them to have larger population size. And then we also tend to have an increase of disease, infectious disease, for example, once we have introduction of large, stable, settled populations in Africa.
Do you have any examples where you've been able to detect multiple migrations that may have been proposed by anthropologists, such as the supposed two migrations that the Chukchis supposedly exhibited across the Bering Straits?
Oh, now you're talking about a region I'm not familiar with. So I can only talk about it within Africa. We certainly did find evidence for historic migration events. So one of which was this, again, we saw sort of a genetic footprint of the Bantu migration from West Africa across different regions of Africa. We also saw evidence for migration of people who speak a Nilo-Saharan language, probably from Sudan and going in two different directions, west and east. So we certainly could see some evidence of ancient migration events. Do we can let her in, then maybe.
Could you summarize a little bit the results that the bidders have?
Oh, okay. So we're just about done with that study, actually. So we looked at PTC is one of the variant or one of the substances that we looked at. And many of you, I don't know if you've had this in maybe your high school biology or undergrad biology, if they ever gave you one of these taste tests. Sometimes they give you like a piece of paper, and about half the class, you know, could taste it and half couldn't. So it's actually highly variable. And there's been this question, why is it so variable? Why can some people taste that and some people can't? And it was well known in Europeans. People had identified the genetic variants, and there were pretty much two genetic variants, and one was associated with the ability to taste, and one was associated with non-tasters. And they were maintained at very high frequency across different European populations. But nobody knew about Africa, so actually we sequenced that gene in, my gosh, how many? I think like 700 people from Cameroon and from Kenya. We gave them that taste test, and we were able to look for associations between different variants. Basically, we found a bit more diversity in the Africans, and we could correlate it with more diversity and ability to taste. But what was actually really interesting is they maintained that taster-non-taster ability, very common across many diverse populations with different diets, which was not what I was expecting. I thought that maybe hunter-gatherers would be different than other groups. What that suggests to us is that those two variants, the ability to taste, and then also people who are non-tasters must be maintained due to selection. But whatever that was, that selective force, I think it was very old. I think it was before the origin of modern humans, probably, you know, certainly older than 100,000 years. What it is, I don't know exactly. But some people have said that perhaps, even though you can't taste PTC, there may be something else that that variant allows you to taste. And so, again, it may be important for avoiding certain poisons or for other aspects that we're not aware of.
Okay, all you super tasters, it's time to go home, I think. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.